You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Author and activist Rahul Mahajan, who recently returned from Iraq, and former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, both spoke on February 5th at a town hall in West Hartford, Connecticut. We're going to play you that town hall, which brings new insights and revelations on the situation in Iraq. In order to preserve as much as possible of the more than two-hour event, we'll postpone our next chapter of Disciplined Minds until next week. Thanks to Dory Smith of WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut, for this material. The first speaker you hear will be Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. Rahul Mahajan.
Intelligence failures. Everybody knows, of course, that there have been massive intelligence failures. There, let's get a show of hands. How many people think there were massive intelligence failures with regard to the weapons of mass destruction? Okay. I want to point out to you that, in fact, there are no intelligence failures. There were no intelligence failures. What happened is we had an administration that decided it was going to go to war on Iraq, decided it would manufacture any excuse it could, and decided it would take people who are supposed to be neutral analysts of what's going on and pressure them until they said things that could be used. Intelligence failures don't even come into the picture. It was lies right from the beginning. I've never, ever seen or even imagined an administration that lies as much as this one. You see, the problem is that all presidents lie and all administrations lie. We discovered this in Vietnam, or we discovered it in Watergate, and we pretty much, most of us, believed it ever since. But usually they try to tell the kind of lie that you have to get some access to information that is hidden to figure out that it's a lie. These guys tell things that all you have to do is read the newspapers to know they're lying. I think we all know that, and yet there's this convenient intelligence failure story. And it goes to every level. So, for example, in August, there was a great article in the Washington Post. By the way, I should recommend to all of you, if you want to find the best reporting on the occupation of Iraq, which is what I'm going to talk about in just a bit, or on the weapons of mass destruction, it's in the Washington Post. It's true. It's better than the reporting in The Guardian or The Independent right now, which is shocking to me, the British papers. And it is worth reading. So anyway, in August, they wrote this brilliant piece, 8,000 words. You can imagine how many people read through to the end of it, all about their lies over nuclear weapons. Remember the aluminum tubes? Powell goes to the Security Council and says, well, I don't know. Maybe they manufacture their tubes to much higher specification than we do. But it seems to me they must be being used for centrifuges for uranium isotope separation and not for artillery. And look, they're anodized. The proof is they have anodized coatings. In fact, if you read this article, which came out only in August, one of the things they'll tell you is that all the experts they talked to said, A, the tubes are not suitable for use in centrifuges. They are for artillery. And B, if you wanted to use them in centrifuges, you'd have to remove the anodized coating. So what was evidence that they were not for centrifuges? Powell told us was evidence that they were for centrifuges. And this is just like one of the tiny little lies in a whole massive structure of lies. The authors of that article were Walter Pincus and Barton Gellman, two reporters at the Washington Post. More recently, after the David Kay thing came out, after he criticized the CIA and intelligence and said they owe the president an apology, it's an interesting idea. So anyway, after this David Kay stuff comes out, Walter Pincus and Dana Milbank write a piece where they say even the most hawkish supporters of the war have to admit that there are serious intelligence failures. After they just wrote this article, Walter Pincus wrote this article himself talking about how they were lying. It wasn't about intelligence failures. So it seems to me there was an intelligence failure here by Walter Pincus. He didn't read his own articles. By the way, I'm kidding. I think he knows what he's doing. But the massive intelligence failure is in all of us and in the media, and I must say in 99% of the Democratic politicians. and not saying, well, this is an administration that lied to get us into war, and that's pretty much all you have to say about it. And all this stuff about intelligence failures is nonsense, is garbage. If they really cared about intelligence, they would have kept guys like Scott on the ground in Iraq instead of pulling them out in December of 1998. One of the things, the conclusions of David Kaye was by far the best source of information about Iraq's WMD was the UN weapons inspectors. And as probably most of you know by now, although you wouldn't know it if you read the New York Times, they left because the United States wanted them out. Bill Clinton wanted to do a little bombing in Iraq, and so he pressured Richard Butler to remove the inspectors. But that is not the subject of my talk today. What I want to talk to you is primarily about what I saw when I went to Iraq. And what I have to tell you is what I learned shocked even me, and I have studied U.S. policy on Iraq very closely as my primary work for a very long time now. It shocked me. It was astonishing. The first thing that I noticed when we flew into Amman and we drove across the border, I was expecting, because of the impression you get, you remember all these stories about foreign infiltrators into Iraq and how the U.S. is cracking down on that. I was expecting tight security. I was expecting all kinds of checks and intrusive searches and a real pain and hours spent at the border. Instead, what happened is this. There are basically two borders you cross. You cross the Jordanian border, which is much like any other country. You know, there is some security. There are some checks. It's normal. It's not a particularly heightened level, but it's like a normal border crossing. Then there's the Iraqi side, the Iraqi border, where there is nothing. Nothing, all right? They don't check anything. They don't have people or personnel to check anything. Literally, I have had, and I'm not joking, I've had more trouble coming back to the United States from Canada than I did crossing into Iraq. In fact, both of the times I've come back from Canada recently, I've been harassed, but that's another story for another day. So that set me thinking, what the hell is going on, right? It's just the opposite of the impression you would have thought. Then we come into Baghdad. It's a long car drive. It's about 12 hours total. We come in, and of course, the one thing I expected to see all over Baghdad was construction. Remember, we're reconstructing Iraq. You've heard about this, right? We're reconstructing Iraq. We're spending $20 billion to reconstruct Iraq, so there must be a lot of reconstruction going on. And amazingly, there was nothing. And I'm not kidding. In all of our time going around Baghdad, I saw two buildings with construction crews. If I'd gone around New Delhi, the same amount of time, I would have expected to see about 50. And New Delhi hasn't been bombed recently. Here's a city full of bombed out buildings. Not a huge number, but a substantial number of bombed out buildings. And there's no construction being done. So I'm seeing this, and I'm saying, what in God's name is going on here? What could be happening? And this is borne out by everyone. Everyone I've talked to, I asked one reporter who's been there since May, is there any reconstruction in Baghdad? He said, well, I saw some guys putting some paint on something a couple times. We actually saw some people painting an underpass some horrible lime green color for no reason I could imagine, but that was all the reconstruction we saw in Baghdad, the whole city of 6 million people. Okay, so I'm a little confused and I'm wondering what's going on. And then, the first thing we do is we go to a couple hospitals. All right, we went to two hospitals, one in Adamiya, which is a heavily Sunni neighborhood. It's very anti-occupation. They say it's the center of the resistance in Baghdad. The other, right across the Tigris River, is Qadamiya, which is a Shia neighborhood, which is mostly, for the most part, they say nominally pro-American, although, as I'll explain to you, pro-American has a specific meaning that's not what you would think when you say it here. In both of these hospitals, we got the same story, which was this. Doctor in the hospital in Qadamiya, when we walked in, the first thing he said was, just today, we ran out of ampicillin. Ampicillin is a very basic antibiotic. They don't have any. He told us. He may have been exaggerating slightly. In fact, I think he probably was. But I think the gist of it was true. He told us they have gotten nothing since the war from the Ministry of Health. I should explain that in Iraq right now, there's a dual-track system of government. There is the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which is the governmental, or you could call it civilian if you were really stretching it, wing of the occupation. And then there is the Iraqi government, and that's Iraqi government in quotes, which is first they created the governing council, then associated with each member on the council, they created a ministry and a bureaucracy to go with it. So there's a Ministry of Health, a Ministry of Electricity, Ministry of Education, and so on. So that's the so-called Iraqi government. And this was a government hospital, so they're supposed to get their drugs from the Ministry of Health. He said, we have gotten nothing from the Ministry of Health since before the war. The doctors in Kadamiya told us this hospital, it's a Kadamiya teaching hospital. It is one of the finest hospitals in Baghdad, or supposedly. It doesn't have heat. So we were there in the winter. It was getting down near freezing. You had, in the pediatric ward, you had kids coming in with respiratory illnesses and having to sit there in the night in freezing temperatures. Sewage backs up onto the floors of the operating theaters. For lack of a machine which they said would cost them about $3,000 would take care of their sewage problem. They don't have it. There's only one functioning elevator in the building. They have a complete shortage of any sort of later generation drugs, the kinds they need to treat specialty cases. They don't have enough respirators. They don't have enough of any basic equipment. All right, they have to turn patients away even though they have empty beds because they simply don't have enough of anything that they need to treat people. And in both of these hospitals, they said, and I don't think they're exaggerating, they said they have less now than they did under the sanctions. I'm sure you've heard some talks, most of you, about the conditions in Iraq under the sanctions. But they have less in the government hospitals now than they did then. We went to a school, which was supposedly, again, one of the finest schools in Baghdad. The former president of Iraq, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, went to this school. Lots of other dignitaries and notables went to this school. During the looting after the war, all of the wiring in the school was ripped out. So, you know, places that can afford it keep going. You all know that there's only electrical power only part of the time in all of Iraq. In Baghdad, it's usually about half the time they have electrical power. So most places that can afford it keep going with generators. But now a school that has no wiring, a generator is not a solution, obviously. To this day, they've gotten nothing from the Ministry of Education. They are teaching children in a school without lights, without electricity. We saw these kids in a room on a very dreary winter day with a little bit of diffused light streaming through the windows trying to read and study. And this is in one of the flagship schools in Baghdad. I'll give you an example that I find perhaps most telling of the difference between this and Saddam's regime. There are many differences, and you've heard a lot about some of those differences. But I'll tell you another difference right here. Across the street from the hotel we stayed in, there is a building, demolished building, which was the telephone exchange for that area. In the Gulf War, it was a four-story building. It was demolished. It was targeted because of their claim that that telecommunications, electrical power, water, and everything else was a military target. It was demolished. And this happened throughout the country, of course. After the Gulf War, there was far more destruction all through Iraq than there was because of this war. Somewhere like, you know, if you want to put a number on it, maybe 5 to 10 times as much destruction, maybe probably more than like 10, after the Gulf War than there was after this war. So then you have this country which has just been shattered by this incredible bombing campaign. It's also under the sanctions, which at that time meant that they could not sell any oil. They could not import any parts. The only things they were really able to import right then after the war was food and medicine. And even then, only if they had the money for it, which they usually didn't. So they had to go on a massive reconstruction campaign entirely through cannibalization. Take machines that were destroyed, take out parts from one destroyed machine, put it in another, and try to make one of the two work. They did this on a countrywide scale. This particular telephone exchange was redesigned to be a two-story building, rebuilt, reconnected to the telephone grid, and they had the phones up and running in 3 months. And this is Throughout Baghdad, at least people told us, 3 to 4 months after the war, they had their phones and their power back. To the degree possible. They couldn't restore the pre-war levels because they couldn't get the parts. This time, 10 months into the occupation, nobody has even swept up the rubble from this bombed out building. That's the level of difference. That's the level of reconstruction. There is, in a sense, there is no government in Iraq. Government in the normal sense that all of us understand it. The thing that provides for all the basic amenities which we don't even notice. Garbage collection. Garbage piles up and rots all over Baghdad. There's no municipal garbage service. Phones. Most people don't have phone service. There's no one supplying it. All the basics of life, and this was a basically, Baghdad was a, more or less, there were poor areas, but more or less it was a middle class society. Not at the level of affluence that we see in the United States, but it's something you can imagine. It was a middle class society with these amenities provided and maintained by the government. Now there's none of that. It's all gone, and they're left to basically stew in their own juices. And so I came to my first conclusion, which stunned me. And I'll say it, and I don't think I've seen anyone say it. You remember how supposedly, after the liberation, one of the great things was that the sanctions would be over, and Iraqis would, of course, get their joyful era of reconstruction and happiness? The sanctions aren't over. The sanctions are worse. Let me describe it in two ways. How did the sanctions actually work? Iraq needed permission from a subcommittee of the Security Council, the Sanctions Committee, to sell its oil. Now, the permission for oil sales after a while were automatically granted. There were many different phases. At times, they could only sell a certain amount of oil, then that amount was increased, and then finally, in the last few years, they were allowed to sell as much oil as they could, which wasn't very much because of the destruction of the oil infrastructure. But they were allowed to sell the oil with the appropriate permission from the Sanctions Commission. Then the money from that oil went into a bank account in New York, from which they were allowed to make requests for disbursements for contracts with foreign corporations. Except in the North, which was treated differently, they were not allowed to use that money for internal spending. They're not allowed to use it to pay salaries or to pay local businessmen. They were allowed only to try to make contracts with foreign corporations. For those contracts, they would have to specify what they wanted to buy, what path it would follow. It goes from the corporation to the warehouse in Baghdad, and who is the end user? That to specify this whole path, put that contract in a request to the Sanctions Committee. They were not allowed ever to address the Sanctions Committee directly. It met behind closed doors. The Iraqi representative was outside. And any member of that committee could hold up indefinitely any contract for any reason. And over the course of, it was really just 6 years of the Oil for Food program, the United States imposed holds on over 1,000 contracts and did it. There's an excellent article by Joy Gordon in the November 2002 issue of Harper's Magazine called Cool War, Economic Sanctions as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, in which she details the extremely malicious way in which the United States denied certain contracts and really tried to keep reconstruction from happening. But anyway, they get through all of that. They get the goods, finally, some of them, some of the time, and then they're distributed to the people who need them, and there are more problems, because you're trying to take in the goods for a whole country, right? And you don't have, you have some massive inventory problem, and you're not allowed to import computers in order to deal with the inventory, so nobody knows how much of anything there is. It's a real pain. You don't have enough transport. At one time, the main warehouse in Baghdad had one operating forklift. You don't have enough refrigerated trucks to carry medicines around. But somehow, these things got around in a limited way, in a very poor fashion, but things got around. And some of them actually worked very well, like the food distribution was regularly praised for its extreme efficiency. That's still continuing now, because what the United States did is simply take over the system the Iraqi created and allow it to work in exactly the same way it did. Everything else, though, has changed. So how has the disbursement of funds changed? Well, now it's not the UN in charge. When Iraq sells its oil, all of the money goes into a fund administered by, any guesses? The Iraqi people? The United States. It's called the Iraq Development Fund. It was created by Security Council Resolution 1483 last May. And it gives, that resolution gives the United States discretionary power over Iraq's oil revenues through the year 2007. Then what happens once it goes into that bank account? Well, you see, there used to be a government of Iraq. It was not a nice government. I have very little good to say about that government of Iraq. But one of the things that it had, which it holds in common with most governments, is it wanted to keep the society running. So it would make plans to keep, to do the things which were necessary, which is not just, you know, day-to-day distributing food, but also making sure the hospitals have some medicine. They did a lot of other things, too. Saddam went on a jag of building palaces and mosques, which everyone in Iraq you talk to will complain about, and they say it was ridiculous. I mean, it was just extreme extravagance. But they also provided food, medicine. They also tried to come through with contracts for infrastructure, for electricity, for water, and so on. Now there is no government of Iraq. There's nobody doing any of this stuff. Nobody is making those plans, and it's all being left. And you go and you try to get answers about anything. When is this going to be fixed? You get shuffled from one person to another, to another, to another. The United States has independently, in Iraq, without reference to that which exists, recreated the concept of third world bureaucracy. It's remarkable. You cannot get any answers. You cannot get any action. Nothing is done. I went through the building of the State Company for Internet Services. You remember another great thing about the liberation? Before, Saddam was not too happy about people having free access to the internet. Because, of course, he figured that 0.1% of people would use it to find out what's going on in the world and political stuff, and 99.9% would use it for pornography. But, you know, he didn't want that 0.1%. And now, with the liberation, of course, we're going to get internet for everyone in Iraq. So I went to the State Company for Internet Services. I walked through the building. And I'm not exaggerating. You're not going to believe me. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that in the entire building of the State Company for Internet Services, there was not a single computer. It's a joke, but it's a very, very bad joke. And it's a joke that is causing a lot of harm and destruction to the people of Iraq. So that was the first thing I learned. And I said, oh my God, this is like 3 days in. I said, well, all those feelings that maybe it wasn't going to be worth the time or the money, you know, 48 hours in Iraq was enough. And I said, well, gee, you know, I've learned so much, and of course I'm reading all this stuff anyway. There's not that much more to learn, right? There's maybe some specifics, but the big picture, I'm not going to learn anything more about the big picture. How mistaken I was. So one day we decided to go and have an audience with the Baghdad chief of police. Now, nominally, you expect the chief of police of a large city is a somewhat important person. I was amazed, you know, who the hell do they think they are just saying we're going to go and walk in and interview the chief of police? Doesn't he have better things to do? We're just a bunch of random activists from the United States. But no problem. We got in. Interestingly enough, when we got in, you remember the Iraqi police is often under attack, and sometimes it's even from the resistance. It's about half and half from the U.S. military and the resistance, but they're under fire from everyone. There was no metal detectors, and we were not frisked. When we walked into the office of the chief of police without ever being checked for weapons. That's how important the chief of police is. Then we were told, you're very, very fortunate to meet with him because he has just this minute come back from 2 weeks at a conference in Tunisia. For Arab ministers of the interior. Oh, wow, he's been really busy and he's going to meet with us. How great. So we walk in. This man has been apparently out of the country for 2 weeks. There's not a single piece of paper on his desk. You know how in offices they have those, on the desk they have those little boxes for in and out? Or is it in and out? No in and out boxes. There was a computer way in the back, but it was clearly for show. It wasn't turned on. We asked him questions like, what's your budget? He said, I don't know. Translating from this whole time, by the way, is the chief of internal affairs of all Iraq's police. Why he's translating, I don't know, because we have our own translators. But that's another story. So this man has nothing to do. He doesn't know what's going on. And after 2 weeks in Tunisia, he has nothing better to do than sit around for an hour answering our questions. And then we terminated the interview. Not him. And this is a standard pattern. You want to talk to American officials in Iraq? No chance. They don't have time for you. They're very busy. They have a lot of work to do. They can, maybe you'll squeeze in 2 minutes somewhere, but probably not. Iraqi officials and the Iraqi government? No problem. Sit, chat for a couple hours, have tea. The entire Iraqi government is basically being given almost nothing to do. You know all this talk about the transfer of sovereignty? This is a fascinating story, right? And if you read the Post and even some of the other papers, you get it. It's a very, very interesting what's going on when the United States, the great beacon of democracy, is regularly getting lessons in the meaning of democracy from a Shia cleric. So the United States says, look, here's our version of democracy. It's very simple. The Supreme Court appoints George Bush. George Bush appoints Paul Bremer. Paul Bremer appoints the Governing Council. The Governing Council appoints people to caucus. The caucus will appoint representatives to an assembly. The assembly will appoint an interim government. That's democracy, right? This is what we all learn about democracy in school. And Ali al-Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, says, seems I read somewhere, I don't know where it was exactly, and you know these, how funny these Shia clerics are, that democracy involves elections somehow. And where are the elections in all of this six or seven layers of appointments? So it's a fascinating story, but the real story is not even there. It's not even in the fact the United States doesn't want elections. Part of the story is this, it's very simple. Even when they first talked about the transfer of sovereignty, you had Ahmad Chalabi and Paul Bremer both saying the same thing, which is, you know, this transfer of sovereignty is really great because now we have an occupying army, and after the transfer of sovereignty, it will be an invited army. Which is to say, we will create that government which invites us to continue the occupation. There's a real transfer of sovereignty for you. All right, so we've known from the beginning that this transfer of sovereignty is a joke. They're going to continue the occupation, they're just going to give it a slightly different face. But what I saw in Iraq tells you it's actually a step beyond that. Forget about transferring sovereignty. There's not even the shred of a chance of that. As of now, they're not even moving to transfer minimal governmental functions. They're not even moving to transfer bureaucratic functions to the government of Iraq. They're not doing them themselves. All the United States is doing in the Sunni triangle, which includes Baghdad, is military operations. Now, we've heard that it's somewhat different in the south. There is some reconstruction going on in the south, but the Sunni triangle is one-third of the population of Iraq. It's not a small amount, and it's not all Sunni, by the way. It's just mostly Sunni. All right, so they're only doing military operations, but they're not creating a government which will carry out the minimal civilian operations. We were told that shortly before we got there, the Minister for Electricity was on TV, on Al Iraqiya, the new TV station created by the United States, that was created by Science Applications International Corporation, because you all know about the great experience they have in media in the Arab world. It was another brilliant decision of theirs. He was on TV saying, he was being asked, you know, what about the electricity? That's something you can ask even on Al-Iraqiya, which in other ways they say it's pretty much not so different from Iraqi state TV under Saddam. And he said, well, I don't have any money. I don't have any funds. I don't have any authority. The Minister for Electricity has no funds or authority to rebuild the electrical power in Iraq. Forget about sovereignty. They're not even allowing the creation of a government. In Palestine, in the Oslo Accords, they created the Palestinian Authority with the clear idea that it was not going to be a state, it was not going to be a sovereign state, but it was going to at least have power to clean up the garbage in the West Bank. This one the United States is creating is not even getting that, the power to clean up the garbage. So forget about any transfer of sovereignty. The whole point of the transfer of sovereignty is pretty much this. In fact, there was another article not long ago in the Washington Post about it. Soldiers in Baghdad are pulling back. They used to have about 60 different military operating locations in Baghdad. Now By now they have about 26, and by mid-April they want to have 8, 2 of which are on the heart of CPA bases, and 6 of which are on the outskirts of the city. So what they want to do with this transfer of sovereignty is continue the occupation, continue the control of the Iraqi people, but simply remove American soldiers from harm's way. Because the one thing that they are getting flack about for the occupation, they're not getting any flack from anyone about the condition of the Iraqi people and what we're doing to the Iraqis, but they are getting flack about the deaths of soldiers. That's the one thing they're getting flack about, and so they're going to move to take care of that in the cynical presumption that that's all that the people of the United States care about, and that after that, Iraq will simply go away as an issue. Everybody in Iraq will tell you, no matter whether they claim they're for Americans against, up or down, will tell you that the transfer of sovereignty is all about the U.S. elections and not about Iraqi elections. And, you know, if things go as they have, then they will be correct in that presumption, because I'm sad to say that even Denis Kucinich, who has the best position of any of the presidential candidates, who actually talks about ending the occupation, when he gets a chance, he says very little or nothing about the condition of Iraqis. He talks again about the deaths of soldiers and the cost of the occupation, but not about what we're really doing to the people of Iraq, let alone why we might be doing that to the people of Iraq. I'm not kidding when I say probably over 95% of people in Baghdad will tell you it's worse now than it was in Saddam's time. And that's a shocking, shocking thing to say, because let me assure you, Iraqis are not stupid. There's no one in Iraq who doesn't understand that Saddam Hussein committed atrocities, that he was a dictator, that it would have been better if he wasn't. All right? They do understand. I mean, again, there's a broad variety of opinions about Saddam. But that much people will say, and they will even say we have more freedom of speech now, although it doesn't matter because nobody pays attention to anything they say. And let me close, since I'm running out of time, with explaining to you what the United States is doing, because what I've told you essentially is what they're not doing. They are treating Iraq as a military campaign. In the Sunni Triangle, they're engaged in search and destroy missions. That's it. And let me describe to you how they work. What everybody Iraqi will tell you when they complain about these things is this. They'll say, if they think there's a suspect in some house, why don't they go, knock on the door, say we need X, and arrest him, the way you do in normal police operations in most of the world, the way even Saddam's police did. Instead, what do? At 3 o'clock in the morning, the family is peacefully sleeping. Suddenly, a tank barrel smashes down the door of their house. People run through yelling in an incomprehensible language, pushing people around, kicking them, shoving them down into the dirt, which is, of course, a very humiliating thing for an Iraqi. Very often they throw the Quran into the dirt, too, just to sort of add insult to injury. If someone is shot, which often happens when they break in, because they're all extremely, extremely paranoid about everything, if someone is shot, we've heard several cases in which they let these people bleed to death while they searched the house, did not give medical attention until after searching the house. So they're right there looking around while people are bleeding to death. We talked with a Human Rights Commission, a group in Iraq, which is documenting these cases, documented in detail about 100 of these cases, and they tell us that in almost every case, the soldiers also steal money and jewelry. So they're destroying people's houses, killing people. Very often, the kinds of tips they get could be anything, all right? Somebody, a neighbor of yours has always hated you, so he goes to the Americans and say, oh, there's someone with the resistance here. That's all it takes. Someone was in the Republican Guard, automatically a suspect. That's 150,000 people. I mean, there's huge, just all kinds of things being done that have nothing to do with ferreting out a resistance. And then what happens if they take someone? Either in a home raid or pick them up off the street. They disappear into the new global gulag archipelago the United States is creating. You've heard a lot about Guantanamo. Unfortunately, you've heard very little about the camps in Iraq, which are very, very similar to Guantanamo. There is the Abu Ghraib prison, whose name may be familiar to you because Saddam used it for the same purpose. There is the airport camp. It's known only as the airport camp or sometimes as Guantanamo. To Iraqis. There is Qasr. There's a big pen down in Qasr. Estimates are somewhere between 13 and 20,000 people are in this, most of them held incommunicado. All right, while the Red Cross was in Iraq, sometimes families could get some communication into prisoners. Now they usually can't. These people are incommunicado. They're being held, when they're released, the stories of people who got out, they're being held in pretty bad conditions. All right. In the summer, in the height of the Baghdad heat, they were in tents without any kind of electricity. They were on rationed water. They're beaten fairly often. The stories of real extreme torture seem to be rare, but then, as we all know just from reading the papers, what the United States does when it wants someone really tortured is outsource it. You know, outsourcing is the way of the world. Send them to Kuwait, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. Now, it's interesting because in many of the cases, we're the ones who taught them initially how to do this torturing, and certainly in Latin America, it was all U.S. training. But now we send it out, and I'll wrap up in just 2 minutes here. So these people are kept in these horrible conditions, up to 20,000 of them. And of course, what's happened in Iraq is there's an atmosphere of total frustration and anger against the occupation and incomprehension, because honestly, a lot of the Iraqis were naive enough to believe some of the promises that the United States made and did not understand that the United States had no intention of fulfilling any of them. And the strange thing is, of course, that all of this is not even fulfilling the designs the United States had. Since I'm out of time, I won't be able to talk to you much about this, which is what are the larger imperial plans, and how does Iraq fit into them, and how does control of oil, which of course everyone sort of knows is involved, but nobody wants to really talk about it, how does control of oil fit into this? But none of this makes much sense, even from their point of view, while they're almost deliberately abandoning Baghdad and Iraq to chaos and anarchy. And I think what has happened is that even the grand planners, the Richard Perls and the Paul Wolfowitzes, who have their plans of their long-term vision of an empire and a new American century, didn't want to think about the plans for how to get from here to there. And Iraq right now stands in the way of getting from here to there, and the only people coming up with policy in Iraq on how to do things day to day are the military. And the military are not part of this grand imperial plan, and they don't know how to fulfill it, and so it's all completely random, and it devolves into basically a military ethic, which is this. In the Sunni triangle, there is resistance. So the military idea is simple. If there's resistance, starve them out. Deny them resources, deny them services. If you're my friend, you get help. That's what happens in much of the South. If you're my enemy, or if there's one in 1,000 of you who are my enemy, you get nothing. And that's pretty much what's happening in Iraq today. Thank you.
That was Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, speaking on February 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut. Next, we'll hear from Scott Ritter, who served as a United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq during the 1990s.
It's an honor and a privilege to be here tonight to talk to you about Iraq. I just wish it was under different circumstances, because the circumstances we face tonight are anything but heartening. We are barely 2 months into a new year. In the first month of this year, over 40 Americans died in combat operations in Iraq. They didn't die storming the beach in Normandy. They didn't die raising the flag at Iwo Jima. They didn't die in classic combat operations, closing with and destroying the enemy through firepower and maneuver. They didn't die in defense of their nation's borders. They died seated in helicopters being shot out of the sky by an enemy they didn't know was down there. They died in an anonymous roadside explosion, an improvised explosive device set by an enemy they didn't know was there. They died with a rocket-propelled grenade bursting through their vehicle, blowing their body apart, fired by an enemy they didn't see. They died asleep at night as mortar shells rained down on their barracks, never knowing that when they went to bed that night, they would never see the light of the next day. That's the way the war is being fought in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Don't for one second believe that this is your classic honorable military operation in defense of the Constitution of the United States of America. American troops are in Iraq today, and they're dying in Iraq today. They're being maimed in Iraq today physically. They're being maimed in Iraq today psychologically. And one has to ask, for what purpose? I say this as a 12-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps who who took the oath proudly as an officer of Marine to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I say this as a veteran of combat operations in defense of this country, in defense of the rule of law. I am no pacifist. I cherish the young men and women who honor us by wearing the uniform of the United States of America. The men and women who do so have made a solemn vow, and it's something every one of us needs to reflect on. They are willing to lay their life down in defense of you. They are willing to sacrifice their life, their limbs, their future in defense of the country that we live in defense of the ideals and the values that are set forth in the Constitution they have sworn to defend. They are willing to die for you, and I ask you tonight, what are you willing to do for them? Because when they are willing to give up their life in defense of a cause, aren't we therefore obligated to ensure that before we ask them to do so, it's a cause worthy of that sacrifice? And I wonder whether anyone in this room, especially after hearing the past presentation, can say that Iraq and what is going on in Iraq today is worth a single drop of American blood. I say no. Prior to this war beginning, one of the framers of the Bush administration's Iraq policy, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, in an interview with Vanity Fair magazine, spoke of the reasons we need to go to war with Iraq. He said, first of all, is the weapons of mass destruction issue. Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, significant quantities that he has retained in violation of his obligation under international law to get rid of these. Saddam Hussein has defied the will of the international community. Saddam Hussein refuses to cooperate with United Nations inspectors, and these weapons in and of themselves pose an inherent risk to international peace and security, and indeed, the security of the United States of America. Reason number one, weapons of mass destruction. Reason number two, are the known links between Saddam Hussein's government and the forces of international terror, in particular, the Al-Qaeda organization of Osama bin Laden, the organization which attacked the United States so viciously on September 11th, 2001, killing nearly 3,000 Americans in the span of less than an hour. Saddam Hussein's links with an organization that has attacked the United States was seen as unacceptable, and in and of itself, justification for military action. Reason number two, known links. And remember, this isn't speculative links. These are links that Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz's boss, said are bulletproof. Links between Saddam Hussein's government and the forces of Al-Qaeda. The third reason is the synergistic effect that comes from the first two. Weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a man who has no regard for international law, a known enemy of the United States, who has links with the forces of international terror, who have already acted to attack the United States. The fact that Saddam could transfer this weapons of mass destruction capability to these terrorists created a new paradigm, a new threshold of threat that had to be dealt with. Threat three, the synergistic effect between weapons of mass destruction and known links with Al-Qaeda. The fourth reason is the criminal nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, the brutal way in which he treated his people, his violations of human rights, his violations of international law, the fact that he has invaded his neighbors twice in the span of less than a decade. And yet Paul Wolfowitz, the man who wanted more than anything to go into Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein, himself said that the fourth reason, the criminal nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, is not worth any American kids getting killed. It's the one of the few times I agree with Paul Wolfowitz. We do not die for the people of Iraq. When I put on the uniform of a United States Marine, I swore to die for you. I swore to die for my country if required. I did not take an oath to the Constitution to die in a far-off country for other people. That's not my job. Paul Wolfowitz said so. I agree with him. So now we face this situation today, 10 months into the occupation of Iraq. No weapons of mass destruction have been found. Scratch reason number one. No link between Saddam Hussein's government and al-Qaeda has been established. In fact, there is an overwhelming body of data which mitigates against there ever having been such a link. Scratch reason number two. And without the first two reasons, you cannot have synergism. There is no synergistic effect between unaccounted for weapons of mass destruction and links with Saddam Hussein. So the only reason American troops are in Iraq dying today is because of the criminal nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, and that is no reason at all. And yet Americans continue to die. And I think we, the people, owe it to them to reflect on why that is the case. George Tenet, the director of the CIA, made a presentation today at Georgetown University, his alma mater, where he was going to explain to we, the people of the United States, about these so-called intelligence failures that led to the president acting on a threat that has failed to materialize. Why did George Tenet speak? Because his appointee, David Kaye, himself a former UN weapons inspector, who was selected by the CIA to head up what's called the Iraq Survey Group, 1,400 Americans, British, and Australian weapons experts who are scouring occupied Iraq with complete access to every industrial facility imaginable, complete access to every single one of the top scientists involved in Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, complete access to all documents necessary which are related to weapons of mass destruction. David Kaye had spent 9 months in Iraq and came to the only conclusion one can come to when confronted with the totality of facts, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There have not been weapons in Iraq since the early 1990s, that UN weapons inspections succeeded, and that, according to him, we all got it wrong. Well, with due respect to David Kaye, I didn't get it wrong. As the man who ran United Nations intelligence operations in Iraq from 1991 to 1998, I perhaps have a unique insight into what the real picture is, not only inside Iraq, but what is transpiring outside of Iraq. I led liaison activities with the CIA. I would spend many days every month in Washington, D.C., having total access to all the intelligence data the United States had about Iraq and their weapons of mass destruction programs. I would fly to London, where I would meet with the British Defense Intelligence Staff and MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service. And again, I had total access to what the British knew about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. From 1994 to 1998, I led the liaison to the State of Israel, where I met with the head of Israeli intelligence. And again, I had total access to everything the Israelis knew about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I also led the investigations in Iraq. And I knew what the United Nations knew about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I can tell you this with all certainty. In 1998, when I left the United Nations, we could account for 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. That's pretty darn good, given their record of lies, deceit, and obstruction. That's why they brought me in as an intelligence officer. You check my resume. You know, when you think you're going to look for chemical weapons, you'd want a chemist. And you're going to look for biological weapons, you'd want a biologist. And nuclear physicist would be useful in the search for nuclear weapons. And there is a role for rocket scientists if you're looking for ballistic missiles. I'm none of those. I'm a spy. I'm an intelligence officer. I do the dirty work. I get in where they don't want you to get in. I get access to the data they don't want you to have access to. And I bring it forward and turn it over to the experts so they can do their disarmament job. And I was darn good at what I did. So when I say 90 to 95%, this is not guesswork, ladies and gentlemen. It means we know what we accomplished. Now, there's 5 to 10% out there that I can't tell you what the final disposition of it was. No one can. Because the Iraqis destroyed their weapons of mass destruction in the summer of 1991 unilaterally without any UN weapons inspectors present. And they did not document this. This meant for us to reconstruct these events, we had to become forensic archaeologists in some case. Forensic investigators. You've seen Crime Scene Investigator, I'm sure, on TV. They've got CSI Las Vegas, CSI Miami, all these very good-looking people running around doing very interesting things. Well, I ran CSI Baghdad. We weren't good-looking. I'm living testimony to that. We were a heck of a sight better than anything you ever saw on TV, and we were real. And we did a good job. So while we couldn't account for it, understand this. Inability to determine the final disposition of something does not automatically translate into retention. And we can mitigate against Iraq's retention of weapons of mass destruction by underscoring that in addition to the disarmament activities, we were monitoring the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure with the most intrusive, comprehensive, technologically advanced on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control. No one has ever seen anything of the likes which we brought into Iraq. Camera systems monitoring the factories 24 hours a day. Sensors sniffing the air. Ruby lasers shooting through the air looking for chemical substances. No notice inspections swooping in, gaining total access to administrative files and budget files. We knew what the Iraqis were doing 24/7, 365 days a year, 366 in a leap year. We know that Iraq was not producing weapons of mass destruction. We know that Iraq did not have the capability, so long as weapons inspectors were in place, to do so. So while we couldn't tell you what happened to everything, we can tell you this. They didn't have viable stocks of weapons of mass destruction as of December 1998, and they were not producing weapons of mass destruction. Now comes 2003, 2002. The President of the United States starts talking about the case for war. The President says some interesting things, like, I know Iraq has chemical weapons. I know Iraq has biological weapons. I know Saddam intends to acquire nuclear weapons. These are stunning assertions. And I may be a simple Marine, but when I hear someone say, I know something, that implies certainty of knowledge. And as an American citizen who believes in the concept of democracy, meaning, Mr. President, with all due respect, you work for me. So when you say you know something and you want me to support a certain policy line, demonstrate how you know. Put the facts on the table. I screamed for these facts. Others asked for them. The President never delivered, telling us that he must hide these facts behind a wall of secrecy because the national security was on the line. Now, I accept that, Mr. President. I'm just a mere citizen. I don't have a need to know the methods and technologies used to gather intelligence. Congress does. Congress has interesting committees, oversight committees, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, for one, who are mandated by the Constitution to review this kind of sensitive information. Why? Because we're dealing with the national security of the United States, and the Constitution is very specific on who has the right and the authority to declare war. That is the sole purview of the Congress of the United States, not the President, not the executive. So if the President of the United States says that we have a case for war based upon intelligence information that says Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, it is the duty and responsibility of the Congress of the United States, these select committees, to say, bring it on, Mr. President, lay it out before us, show us what you got so we can support you. Congress did not do this, ladies and gentlemen. Congress did not do this. In August of 2002, I was in Washington, D.C. I met with members of the Select Intelligence Committee, including Dianne Feinstein, one of the senior Democrats, and somebody who was opposed to war with Iraq. I sat down with her. I said, look, Madam Senator, I'm a loyal American. If Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction more than 10 years after the Security Council said he can't, I presume ill intent. And I'll be the first to line up and sign up for the Marine Corps to lead the charge into Baghdad, because I'm all about enforcement of the law. And if we pass a law that says he can't have these weapons, and he does, bring it on. I don't want to be an impediment to the national security of the United States. I have no right to know exactly what you know, but just look me in the eye and tell me that you have seen factual data to sustain the president's allegations. Just tell me, yes, I have seen hard facts. She said, I haven't seen anything. This is August 2002. On August 29, 2002, the President of the United States signed the execute orders to go to war in Iraq. Now, that's an important date, because in September, in October of 2002, the President sent members of his administration to sit before Congress, and they were asked this specifically. John Kerry, one of the leading candidates for the Democratic nomination, said, if there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, if weapons inspectors go in and find nothing, removing the cause for war, would the president still seek to go to war? And Colin Powell said, no. If we remove the causes belli, there's no need for military action. Furthermore, the president of the United States has not made a decision to go to war. That was a blatant lie, ladies and gentlemen, a blatant lie told by a government official to the Congress of the United States. Now, I'm a simple man, but I understand this. A government official who tells a lie in the conduct of his or her duty has committed a felony. A felony is a high crime, a misdemeanor that has specific language in the Constitution called for impeachment. But it's not just Colin Powell who told lies. It's Donald Rumsfeld who said the same thing. It's Condoleezza Rice who said the same thing. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the President of the United States who has told lies. Now, George Tenet today in Georgetown said, no, don't blame the president. He didn't lie. The president just didn't have perfect intelligence. I agree. But I'm also dealing with the professional aspect of the intelligence equation. George Tenet, excuse me, that was a cheap shot. I shouldn't have done that. George Tenet made a speech today that Bob Gallucci, my former boss in the United Nations, called a great performance. And I agree totally. It was a performance. It was a bit of theater on the same line as Colin Powell's presentation to the Security Council on 5 February of last year. Ladies and gentlemen, need I remind you that the brilliant case that Colin Powell laid out to the Security Council, not a single point he made has turned out to be true. In fact, every single point has been shown to be false. Now, Colin Powell is justifying this, saying, I acted on the best intelligence that was available. No, Mr. Powell, you didn't. You know better than this, Mr. Powell. Because you used to be General Powell, who used to be Captain Powell, who served in Vietnam and understands what happens when ideologically motivated policymakers start twisting the truth for their own objectives, and you swore that if you ever got into a position of power, you would never allow this to happen. You betrayed the troops, Mr. Powell. You betrayed the troops. Now we have George Tenet saying the same thing. But I ask you to consider this. In this speech, review his testimony. It is full of speculation. It is full of rhetoric. It is full of assessments. It is full of assumptions. It lacks any factual data whatsoever. None. The CIA, and I can guarantee you this, had no factual data to sustain any allegation that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. It's not just the CIA. The British had none, the French had none, the Russians had none, the Israelis had none. As I said, I was the chief liaison with Israel. If any nation needs to fear Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, it's the state of Israel. When I went to Israel in 1994, I was told by the director of military intelligence that Iraq was the number one threat to Israel because of their weapons of mass destruction. And after over 30 visits and many months and hard work,